Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We've had some problems with our main studio computer, server for our radio station. So today we're doing remotely from a home computer. I don't know how this is going to work, but we're going to give it a try. Thank you for joining us for episode 25 from the Eastern Files. The program is dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the new Eastern as it comes to us. Today's broadcast from the Eastern Files pays tribute to a great friend of mine and the radio show, Howard Mucci. Howard passed away last month, January 5th, at the age of 95. Only a few days earlier, he was making suggestions for future radio show programs. He contributed to several of our radio shows hits by offering stories from his book, All the Stories from Here and There. I chose two stories from this book for today's broadcast. Remember now, we continue to broadcast our Normal Talk Radio call-in live show every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Be sure to tune us in. Now, let's hear a commercial from Eastern Airlines.
Fly Eastern Airlines, Eastern Airlines.
Fly Eastern.
You'll love to travel by
Eastern.
Where new things are happening.
Eastern.
Fly Eastern Airlines. From the ground up.
Traveling on Eastern's easier.
From the ground up.
Eastern service is speedier.
Fly Eastern Airlines. Eastern Airlines.
The first story I will share with you today is called National Treasuries, written, of course, by Howard Mucci. I had been in Tokyo, Japan, on business and was checking out out of the new Tokyo hotel where I'd been staying. I stood in line waiting for the hotel bus to the airport, along with a half dozen other travelers. The bus appeared shortly, and the driver loaded the baggage into the rear while the passengers took their seats. There was one passenger, however, who took his yellow suitcase on the bus with him and set it in the aisle, making it necessary for people to step around his suitcase. I sat two seats behind him, immediately noticing how nervous he was and how he lit one cigarette after another. In the half-hour ride to the airport, he smoked no less than five cigarettes. It was September of 1985, and Japan Airlines had lost a 747 the previous month in the waters of Tokyo Bay, resulting in some 500 deaths. The cause of disaster was still under investigation. Here I was flying home on JAL, and this recent tragedy suddenly seemed to occupy my thoughts. After we reached the airport, I collected my luggage and caught up with a passenger who had aroused my suspicions. I watched as he got in the ticketing line to check his bag. For some reason, I became even more apprehensive. I got out of line and tried to find an English-speaking supervisor. I finally found an individual who spoke some English. He, in turn, brought me to his superior, who spoke excellent English. I told him what I had observed and the reason for my concerns. I told him I felt so strongly that something was wrong that I was not about to board the aircraft until this passenger and his luggage were investigated. I described the passenger as wearing a black leather jacket with some sort of design on the back, and he had eyeglasses with black frames. I also gave him a description of the suitcase and the number of the station where he had checked in. He listened attentively to everything I said and then made several phone calls, none of which I could understand. One call must have been to security because it wasn't long before I noticed two security men talking to the passengers in question who was buying a magazine. I was leaning against the far wall, and being much taller than most Japanese, I could easily see what was going on. Suddenly, there was a lot of commotion as a man took off running. Now whistles were blowing, and there was a complete airport alert with security police appearing from all directions. In the meantime, a man from airport security asked me to come with them, and they seated me in a private room. It wasn't long before the supervisor appeared and asked me if I would mind repeating what had aroused my suspicions. I explained my observations of his nervous behavior as we were leaving the hotel, how his hand never left the suitcase, and how he insisted on having the suitcase next to him on the ride to the airport. A supervisor wrote everything down and then left, but not before asking if I would like some tea. Finally, the supervisor returned, accompanied by two grim-faced individuals who were obviously the police. The English-speaking supervisor said my suspicions were indeed well-founded. However, it was not a bomb that the suspect was carrying. Instead, a search of his luggage revealed he was carrying stolen national treasuries. It seems there had been a recent theft at the Museum of Antiquities, and this individual was trying to smuggle some of these artifacts out of the country. He stated further that the suspect in question had escaped from the terminal, but was caught trying to climb over the fences surrounding the airport. He proceeded to say the country of Japan, as well as Japan Airlines, were most grateful to me for being so observant. He asked my full name and address, saying I would be receiving a formal recognition from the Ministry of Antiquities along with Japan Airlines. The other gentlemen, who never identified themselves, apparently did not speak English. Nonetheless, they bowed in unison with the supervisor. I murmured my acknowledgement, and we all left the room together. I thought at first I had probably missed my plane, but with all the commotion, the airport had been shut down and all departures had been delayed. As I went to check in, a young JAL employee stopped up next to me and escorted me past all the waiting passengers to a seat in the first class section. I had so much attention on the way home, I felt like I was in a harem. Flight attendants constantly hovering over me, waiting to carry out my every need, from lighting my cigarettes as soon as I put one in my mouth, to keeping my drink glasses filled, whether I wanted them filled or not. Excuse for the pause, but I have to turn the page. When we finally arrived at Chicago O'Hare, the entire crew, including the captain, stood, each bowing and thanking me. About 3 weeks later, I received a letter from the Minister of Antiquities thanking me for the valuable service I had rendered to the country of Japan. This was followed by another letter from the president of JAL, also thanking me and stating that I would always be a preferred passenger. Some months later, I was making another trip to the Orient and naturally chose to travel by Japan Airlines. From the time I boarded until I finally disembarked at my destination, not one airline employee recognized me or acknowledged my presence in any way. And here I thought I had become a household word in Japan. Note, fame is fleeting and soon becomes nothing more than a fading memory. Story by Howard Mucci. Now, a little bit about Howard and the background of Howard growing up. And I wanted to read you this because he accomplished so much in his lifetime. This little short story is called Growing Up, simply Growing Up. My given name was Reginald Howard Olaf Brandt. I was born in Germany on January 22, 1922, in a small town called Hochspire, not far from Mannheim, Germany. My father, Hubert Brandt, was a school teacher who decided to immigrate to America and, once settled, planned to have my mother follow. Sadly, she waited vainly for more than a year and never received a letter or heard a word from him. Nor did she ever hear from him again. My mother's brother George had come here some years earlier and had already received his citizenship. He owned a fairly large restaurant in Flushing, New York, and his business was doing well. He agreed to sponsor my mother and guarantee her job. So when I was 4 years old, we left Germany for the United States, and my mother went to work for my uncle as a waitress in his wet restaurant. In 1928, she had my biological father, Hubert Brandt, declared legally dead. Subsequently, she met Frederick Mucci, who was a frequent diner at the restaurant where she worked and who would, in due time, be her stepfather. After her marriage, my stepfather adopted me and said my first name would henceforth be Howard. My mother said years later he couldn't stand a name for a boy like Reggie. A few years later, my brother Charles was born, and the family moved to Hasbrouck Heights, New Jersey, where my father had rented a house located adjacent to the grade school. Again, I will turn a page. As a result, I would never miss a day of school, regardless of the weather. If it was probably a good thing, because I somehow managed to skip the fourth grade. In 1936, we had moved to Rutherford, New Jersey, where I went to high school. I was a very good math student, and the sciences came easy to me. In the way of sports, I was too small for football, fast but not fast enough for track, and I didn't like baseball. I did like gymnastics until I fell on my face from a trapeze and broke my nose considerably, dampening my enthusiasm for gymnastics. I thought I wanted to be an engineer. To be a good engineer, my father said I had to learn to work with my hands. So every summer, he made arrangements for me to work at some trade. One summer, I worked for a carpenter. The next summer, as for an electrician. The next, for a machinist. Training I not only enjoyed, but fully appreciated much more in later years. In 1939, I had just graduated from high school and was accepted at Columbia University. I was not exactly sure what discipline I wanted to pursue, but Columbia University had offered a partial scholarship based on my grades. My mother was a typical German Hausfrau. she had no equal when it came to cooking and baking. She sewed everything from drapes to clothes and always kept an immaculate house. She wasn't overly demonstrative, almost always deferring to my father, but there were times when she interceded if she thought he was expecting too much of us. My father was a man who didn't necessarily equate bonding with upbringing. He was a bit of a martinet and felt his primary objective was to prepare his children to meet life's challenges. He had an engineering degree. He was a better than average artist. He played the violin, had a good knowledge of music, and was fluent in three languages. My brother and I regarded him with respect that bordered on fear. Not because he ever abused us in any way, but because he was such a perfectionist, always demanding we do our best no matter what we did. He worked as a patent attorney and had a small office in New York City where he specialized in foreign patents and also helped inventors with prototypes, sometimes taking an interest rather than payment. His income was therefore unpredictable. Money, or more correctly, the absence thereof, was a constant source of argument at our house. I can still remember many times when all we had for dinner was soup, made from soup bones the butcher gave away, and 10 cents worth of greens. One day there was an ad in the paper for engineers in a nearby Bendix plant. My father had a degree in mechanical engineering, and so my mother begged him to apply for the job so he would have a paycheck every week and wouldn't have to commute to New York City. The family financial situation gradually got worse. My father had bought a house with little or nothing down, and we were doing the remodeling ourselves. By that, I mean my father, my mother, my brother, and I, working every evening and weekend. While the labor was entirely free, there was still the expense of materials, and the unpaid bills were starting to accumulate. My father had come to the end of his rope and had finally gone for a job interview where he was immediately accepted. I will turn a page. He came home and said he would start in 2 weeks because he had some commitments in his business. My mother breathed a sigh of relief and couldn't wait for my father to start his new job. A few days later, my father came home early from work, complaining of severe abdominal pain. When my father complained, you knew it was serious, so my mother immediately called the doctor. He examined my father and thought it might be his appendix and had him taken to the hospital. There, they thought at first he had an infection of the pancreas, but later it was diagnosed as cancer of the pancreas. There was no treatment or cure. We went to visit my father at the hospital for 2 days. On the fifth day, he died. A week later, we buried him with a few close friends and some business associates present. What a strange quirk of fate. We buried him on the day he was supposed to start work. My poor mother, poor in more than the literal sense, would never see that weekly paycheck. This was a real traumatic time for our family. My mother reached out to her brother George for help. He said, "I helped you once. If you can't find better husbands, that's your problem, not mine." Not exactly what I considered a Christian attitude. My father had a brother who lived in New York City and worked in a bank. He and my father were not very close. I can only recall seeing him a few times, always driving a big new Buick. I can still remember my father saying, He does not own a pot, not even one he can piss in. Sure enough, when my mother approached him, he claimed he was head over heels in debt and there was no way he could help her. The refusal of both my uncles to help out left me with certain bitterness towards life's inequities and the unpredictable nature of family relations. So here was my mother with two teenagers, a mountain of debt, and no insurance. With no income, we were at the mercy of our creditors. Unfortunately, there was no mercy. The bank immediately foreclosed, and we had 30 days to get out. Welfare, what there was of that at that time, was simply not an option. There was no way my mother would even consider welfare. My mother wanted a place to live in the same general neighborhood because my brother, who was 12 years old, was still in school. She had no money for a rent deposit, which posed a real problem. She finally found a good-hearted lady who had an upstairs apartment for rent and who told her we could live there rent-free until she found work. The next day, a neighbor with a pickup truck helped us move our beds, a few pieces of furniture, some personal belongings, and our dog, Billy. That night, I remember my mother saying, "We should be grateful we have a roof over our heads." I didn't quite see it that way. Our house was gone, and with all the long hours we had put in remodeling, we had no money. To me, destitute was no longer a word, but a reality. My mother found work as a seamstress, commuting by bus to a nearby town. My brother worked after school at a grocery. I gave up any thoughts of going to Columbia and became instead the big wage earner. A friend of my father helped me get a job at RCA in Harrison, New Jersey. I started work on the third shift for 30 cents an hour. At the end of the second week, we had three paychecks. My mother was able to pay the rent, and I still remember that night my mother splurged on a pork roast. My job at RCA involved a chemical process which was conducted in a small room off by itself. The job was easy, and I had a certain amount of free time. Deciding that the place could use a coat of paint, I asked a maintenance man if he could give me some paint and some brushes. The next night, when I came to work, I found the paint and brushes. As soon as I was caught up, I started painting. I was incidentally a very good painter, having worked at house remodeling. One night, as I was painting, the third shift supervisor stopped by, thinking I was part of the maintenance crew, and asked what I was doing. I told him my job left me with some free time and the place was sorely in need of a coat of paint. He watched me briefly and went on his way. After that, he would occasionally stop by, and I was always either working at my job or painting. On a Friday night, he stopped by to inform me that starting the following week, I would be working the day shift, and I was being promoted with a raise of 5 cents an hour. When I came home Saturday morning, I immediately got my mother out of bed. I couldn't wait to tell her about my 5 cent raise, which amounted to now $2 a week. I was assigned to the chemical department, and my new boss told me if I wanted to pursue a course in engineering, RCA had a liberal reimbursement plan for tuition and books, provided you maintained good grades and courses were relevant to the job. I immediately decided on Brooklyn Polytech Institute, which was convenient by train and subway. With little time left for registration, I went immediately after work to enroll. Unfortunately, I soon learned the tuition had to be paid in advance. This was something I had not thought about, and there was simply no way we could afford it. I went to work that Monday, and my dejection must have been obvious. After lunch, my boss stopped by to ask what was the matter. I told him what had happened, and with the family finances being what they were, I could not afford the tuition right now. He just listened and never said a word. Later on, he asked me how much the tuition was, and I told him. As I was getting ready to go home, he called me into his office and handed me a RCA check for a tuition advance and told me this was the last day to register, so I'd better get myself over there. I was so overwhelmed, just stood there, absolutely dumbfounded, tears welling in my eyes. He finally said, "Get going. You'll miss your train." How wonderfully odd when I really thought the whole world was against me. I suddenly discovered strangers who went out of their way to help. I decided maybe my original premise was wrong and the world wasn't such a bad place after all. To this day, I will always remember RCA as a company with compassionate people who are really concerned about their fellow man. I thank all those who assisted me so much in getting an education. In my heart, I still thank all the others who went out of their way to help me. I truly believe the saying, God helps those who help themselves, and God blesses those who help others. I know this experience shaped my philosophy about life. And to finish the story, I went to school four nights a week with classes from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. My biggest problem was commuting from Harrison, New Jersey, where RCA was located. I took a train to Journal Square, from there the subway to New York, and then another subway to Brooklyn. I made a quick stop at a sandwich shop, ate on the run, and if I was lucky, got to class barely on time. Classes were over at 10 p.m., but coming home, it took two subways and two buses. If I missed connection, I would not get home until well after midnight. I had only one bus ride and a short walk to get to work. Still, I had to get up at 6 a.m. to be there on time. With homework almost every night, I wasn't always sure what day it was. Still, I maintained good grades and worked hard at my job. In the 3 years I was employed by RCA, I received several promotions and received two annual awards for the best cost-saving suggestions at RCA. In June of 1943, I enlisted in the Air Force and said my goodbyes to all the people who had been so good to me. Those two stories, I could share another one, but we are lacking the time to do so. Because I would like to now make a remark about Howard Mucci, my best friend. I would meet Howard twice a week for breakfast, or we went fishing. The inspiration he gave me from those meetings may be the resource I need to write my own collection of memories of this remarkable man. He loved to take part in and listen to our weekly broadcast, many of which were suggestions he made for future programs. One favorite part he enjoyed doing in one show was that of being cast for the Captain Eddie Rickenbacker role as a World War I fighter pilot ace. He was 92 when this was broadcast. Howard liked the reading of the Hoplite poem, which we did read and cite on occasion on our radio show. He was a pilot, and he owned his own Cessna back when he was much younger and owned a company, his own company, manufacturing computer boards for Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. So I want to conclude today's show by reading that poem in tribute to a dear pilot friend, Howard Mucci. poem is High Flight, written in 1941 by 19-year-old pilot officer John Gillespie McGee, Jr., 3 months before he was killed. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter's silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sunsplit clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of. Wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while with silent lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. So long, Howard. You will always be remembered. We hope you enjoyed today's broadcast from the Eastern Files, and if you would like to contribute a story from your own Eastern days and in your own voice or to be read on the broadcast, please give us an email and we will show you how simple it is to tell your story on from the Eastern Files. You can send it to host@ealradioshow.com. We want you to be part of the radio show. And until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say, so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern. Now, here is the song, High Flight, sung by John Denver, as the sign-off music we have for today's show.
My hand and touch the face of God.